All right. Good morning, everybody. Today is Wednesday, October 21st, 2015. And this is Before the First Cup of Jewels here on UCY.TV. Happy Wednesday, everybody. It is, 52 degrees and raining here in upstate New York. It's kind of miserable. It's one of those days that makes you want to go back to bed. So where did we leave off yesterday? We titled the show Precision Medicine, DNA, Google, Kurzweil, and Nanobots. And we looked at some pretty crazy stuff. We outlined over the last few days, and actually over the last 6+ months, kind of the connections between the federal government, the bioeconomy, and the National Bioeconomy Blueprint, 21st Century Medicine, Big Data. We looked at how all of the tech billionaires are right in bed with this longevity medicine and precision medicine, mad science gone mad type stuff, the mapping the genome, the brain project. Yes, it is all part of the same thing. One of the things that came up a few days ago and something that we were reading was about ethics and bioethics and some of these crazy experiments that they are doing. And I had kind of laughed at that and said, yeah, I don't think that there's much in the way of ethics left. I found out something really disturbing. The one story had mentioned the President's Council on Bioethics, and I laughed and said, yeah, I bet that's not in existence anymore. Well, check this out. I looked on Wikipedia, the President's Council on Bioethics. Wait till you hear this. The President's Council on Bioethics was a group of individuals appointed by the United States President G.W. Bush to advise his administration on bioethics. And wow, isn't that an oxymoron? Established on November 28th, 2001 by executive order, so shortly after September 11th, the council was directed to, quote, advise the president on bioethical issues that may emerge as a consequence of advances in biomedical science and technology. Now, remember, right after September 11th, that was when we had that anthrax scare and, oh, my God, the terrorists, the bio agents are coming to get us. And there was a lot of stuff that was going on behind closed doors that I don't think we are fully aware of. We have connected the original bio weapon program and chemical weapon program. Wow, I gotta stop this computer from trying to reboot me every day during my show. The bio weapons program. How once Nixon inked the agreement, 50 years later, I was reading last night, after the original Nuremberg documents in like 1925, it took us 50 years to ink that and sign on. But once we've done that, Nixon had stated that we were still going to be pursuing biotechnology, I guess, or at least a defensive posture against bioweapons in and under the guise of vaccinations. So it's very interesting that as the war on terror began, George W. Bush created by executive order a council on bioethics. But what's even more surprising is what comes in the next paragraph. So anyway, it says, to finish up this paragraph, it succeeded, so G.W. Bush's panel, and largely replaced the National Bioethics Advisory Commission, which was appointed by Bill Clinton in 1996 and which expired in 2001. All right, well, here we go. So the members of the council were appointed directly by the president. The president also chose the chairperson of the council. Last appointed chair was Edmund D. Pellegrino, and I didn't look into who he is or who he's affiliated with. Council members, totaling no more than 18, were appointed for a 2-year term, after which time they could be reappointed by the president. Individuals appointed could not be officers or employees of the federal government. The executive order was renewed in 2003, 2005, and again in 2007. But in June of 2009, now President Barack Obama informed members of the council that their services were no longer needed. Through a spokesperson, Obama made clear that he intended to replace the committee with a body that offers practical policy options rather than philosophical guidance. Executive Order 13521 of November 24, 2009 superseded the previous council by establishing the Presidential Commission for the Study of Bioethical Issues. So I guess we're not going to practice bioethics anymore. We're just going to study bioethics and then kind of meld it to our own requirements. So on Wednesday, November 25th, 2009, Obama named Amy Gutman, G-U-T-M-A-N-N, again, I don't know who she is, the president of the University of Pennsylvania, to chair his new advisory panel on bioethics. James W. Wagner, the president of Emory University, was appointed a chairperson. And, you know, even though I don't know who these people are, something that's pretty interesting is that he's sticking these heads of universities that I'm sure probably get federal dollars for mad science gone mad research. And under criticism, it says critics such as Elizabeth Blackburn, who was fired from the original commission, accused it of being set up to justify President Bush's position on stem cell research and abortion and his alleged distortions of science. So she must have been way back when. Bioethicist Leslie A. Metzler accused the council of wrapping, quote, political and religious agendas in the guise of dignity and described them as largely Christian-affiliated neoconservatives, philosophers, and political scientists rather than bench scientists. Metzler said that the council members mischaracterized the positions of their opponents and used invective rather than addressing the merits of the argument. So this is going back to the stem cell argument back in Bush's day. And yes, if we remember, Bush had a lot of radical Christian crazies involved who were very against anything to do with stem cell research. Back in that time, they were using aborted fetuses. And I don't know, that's like a big ball of ugly wax to deal with. I'm not going to get into that argument today. Regardless of what you think, they were doing stem cell research in other areas of the world and made leaps and bounds above what the United States research was able to do legally with funding because they hadn't banned any of that tissue. Now that doesn't matter anymore. They found a way to coax skin cells into stem cells from you, the individual, for their precision medicine. So they can turn your cells into anything now. So really this abortive fetus issue does not figure into this precision medicine story, at least on the surface level. But I guess what I wanted to point to here is that Obama dismantled this group of bioethicists, regardless of who they were. At least we had somebody on the crew who was calling bullshit to dropping the pants of regulatory agencies and making a direct connect line to Big Pharma. I'm going to read the last paragraph. It says, the response to Obama's decision to disband this council drew both criticism and praise. Colleen Carroll Campbell, a former speechwriter for Bush and a member of the conservative advocacy group Ethics and Public Policy Center, predicted that Obama's desire to see his policies backed by expert consensus more likely will be realized with a new commission composed of like-minded political liberals steeped in Unitarianism than with brainy, diverse, and unpredictable crew that populated the now-defunct council. And I mean, isn't that the way the Supreme Court works? As presidents appoint their own court justices, of course, they're going to do it in their own image for people that agree with them. I just, this is something that I'm going to dig more into because I didn't even realize that there had been a council on bioethics or that presidents via executive order could abolish or create them at will. And it's very disturbing when we look at now this unification between medicine, big data, big pharma, and federal government, educational institutions, and this whole global bag closing on us to be able to manipulate and control life at a cellular, molecular, and DNA level. It's very, very scary. So nobody is watching the store. It's all going to be skewed to whatever the belief system is at the time. Isn't that the way it always works? And then we find out that Obama is hiring someone to help them spin the federal marketing message now to be able to sell these programs. And we have the now who's leaving, the current and soon to be former director of the National Institute of Mental Health, who's going to work for Google, who's in bed with all of this. So I don't know, just kind of regurgitating some things, but here's a good one. Let's do this. Thank God I'm not a dad. Stressed dads affect offspring brain development through sperm microRNA. Says more and more scientists have realized that DNA is not the only way that a parent can pass traits onto their offspring. Events experienced by a parent over time can also have an impact. We talked about that. They discovered that even stress in your young life could damage your DNA that then you could pass down to future generations. And remember, when we look at this whole eugenics agenda, especially if they find a way to cure aging so we can live to be 500 and some odd years old, whatever, that we won't be good breeding stock if we had stress or we ate, I don't know, pizzas on Fridays or we drank alcohol and damaged our liver. Now the University of Pennsylvania researchers, and you know, interesting that Obama appointed, is that what they said? Let me go back here for a second. Who I thought he said, yeah, the president of the University of Pennsylvania. That's like the third story, and I'm trying to remember what other one just came out of the University of Pennsylvania. There was some other crazy research. Now the University of Pennsylvania researchers have shown at the molecular level how experiencing stress changes a male mouse's sperm in such a way that it affects his offspring's response to stress. This change is imparted epigenetically. And we read about epigenetics, how your grandma's living through the depression could be affecting your genes. Or through means other than the DNA code by molecules called microRNAs or MIRs. I haven't quite heard them called MIRs. That they called them mRNAs, but maybe that's messenger, and microRNAs are MIRs. The work led by Tracy L. Bale, professor of neuroscience in Penn School of Veterinary Medicine and Perelman School of Medicine, provides important clues for understanding how a father's life experiences may affect his children's brain development and the mental health through purely biological and not behavioral means. It's remarkable to me that seemingly mild stress to a male mouse would trigger this massive change in microRNA response, and that would get wired into the course of his offspring's development, said Bale. She collaborated on the work with graduate students Ali B. Rogers and Christopher P. Morgan, and research specialist N. Adrian Liu of Penn Vet. And the paper will appear in the Proceedings of National Academy of Sciences. In earlier research, Bale's lab had shown that male mice who were stressed prior to being bred by such means as changing cages or exposing them to a predator odor of fox urine had offspring with a damaged response to stress. And when compared sperm from the stressed fathers to their unstressed counterparts, they found increased expression of 9 MIRs in the stressed animals. Unlike some other types of RNA, MIRs do not code for protein. Instead, they serve to silence or degrade specific messenger RNAs, preventing them from being translated into proteins. So how interesting that stress silences or degrades messenger RNAs. And I am pretty certain that this is some of that same RNAi technology. That's how that works. They use messenger RNAs to silence genes. Just showing that the levels were different doesn't make it relevant or interesting, Bale said. We wanted to find out whether or not they were having a causal role. And to find out, the team micro-injected the 9 MIRs into mouse zygotes, which are the beginning growings of the eggs, which were then implanted into normal female mice who carried them as surrogates. They also included control groups in which zygotes received either a sham injection or an injection of a single MIR. And when the offspring became adults, the researchers examined their response to stress, just as they had done in the 2013 study. The results mapped right into what we had shown before, said Bale. And when subjected to a mild stress, in this case, being restrained briefly, the offspring that arose from the zygotes that received the multi-MIR injections had lower cortisone levels compared to offsprings in the control group. The mice in the multi-MIR injection group also had significant changes in the expression of hundreds of genes in the paraventricular nucleus, a brain region involved in directing stress regulation, suggesting widespread changes in neurodevelopment. Now, this is extremely interesting as we see the last 15, 14 years or so has been highly stressful for people not only in the United States but around the world, not only with the whole war on terror, we're going to be attacked all the time, fear, 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 but also with now everything that's going on in the Middle East and all the migration. Look at all the stress, how many millions of people at one time are under stress. So let's figure out what this is going to do to future generations, because it looks to me like this next generation up and coming, anyone who's been born after 2001 on forward, are going to have some damage. And I mean literally a significant change in the expression of hundreds of genes in the brain directing stress regulation. That is highly significant. Finally, how interesting too, this research is being done at the University of Pennsylvania, where the director of the Council on Bioethics for Obama has been appointed from. Finally, the researchers aim to determine how the MIRs were carrying out this effect after fertilization. Because MIRs are known to target and degrade mRNA, the team looked at the stored maternal mRNA, a genetic bundle that is contained in the egg when it is fused with the sperm and exists for only a brief window of time to direct early zygotic development. You know, also I'm thinking, like, how would this apply, since they are talking about sperm and offspring from men who have felt stress, how is this affecting children of people who've been in the military and have seen battle, especially? And I mean, You don't have to see battle even. They're talking about a stress as in moving a mouse from one cage to another or giving them a sense of a predator. I mean, that wasn't any major stress there. Maybe for a little mousy, but it wasn't like the mousy almost died. It was just stress hormone. Anyway, the team looked at the stored maternal mRNA, a genetic bundle that is contained in the egg when it is fused with the sperm and exists only for a brief window of time to direct early zygotic development. Quote, people used to think that because the stored maternal mRNA got translated during that initial two-cell and four-cell development, the mom gets a lot of say in those early stages and the dad gets no say, said Bale. But we thought maybe these sperm MIRs could be attacking that maternal mRNA and directing which mRNAs get translated. So, because we have so many ethics, the researchers again injected MIRs into zygotes and performed controlled injections. Oh my God, what a term that is. Controlled injections. But this time they incubated the zygotes for 8 hours. And then they amplified the RNA in each single cell to look for gene expression levels. And they found that indeed the multi-MIR injection appeared to be attacking the maternal mRNA, resulting in a reduction in those mRNA levels compared to the control injections. Specifically, affected genes involved in chromatin remodeling. And I don't know what chromatin is. We'll have to make a note of that one. C-H-R-O-M-A-T-I-N. Bale suspects that when a male experiences stress, it may trigger the release of MIRs contained in exosomes from the epithelial cells that line the epididymis, the storage and maturation site for the sperm between the testes and the vas deferens. These MIRs may be incorporated into the maturing sperm and influence development at fertilization. Up next for the group, including Penn Vet graduate student Jen Chan, who is now taking over the project, is to examine what upstream factors could lead to exosome and MIR release when an intervention, such as providing stressed males with enrichment or a reward, might prevent them from passing on an abnormal stress response to the next generation. They also hope to study the role of MIRs in humans. Yeah. I'm sure that experiment's been going on now for quite a while to discern whether some may vary in response to stress in a similar way as in mice. And this work was supported by who? The National Institute of Mental Health. So, if we hadn't had an interruption, there was a segue here to the last story. But how interesting is that? So we read a while ago that stress could affect future generations, but now we're reading that it actually can affect the brain of future generations. And I'm not actually understanding like what the end result is of the stress, but we'll dig into this more because that's definitely an interesting side effect, especially looking at the political climate that we have now. I'm going to drop that in the chat right now for anyone who wants to look at that. So I guess today, since I've kind of lost the entire train of thought here, we're just going to hit these stories I have and we'll see if we can stitch it together. There was something else I ran across yesterday by total absolute accident, but we talked about in reference to that anthrax, quote-unquote, scare in 2001 that happened shortly after 9/11. We had referenced also a show that Tim Kelly had done on Our Interesting Times that we run on the weekend, and then I replay it on Mondays. It was an excellent interview with a professor out of Canada talking about this anthrax scare, and especially now when we look at over the last year from beginning in last July through the summer, we found out that not only the CDC, but then also the Department of Defense, And it wasn't just Dugway Proving Ground. It was all these other locations. They'd shipped out anthrax that they thought had been inactivated by radiation. And they found out that it wasn't inactivated. I was trying to find an exact number. And there were all kinds of different numbers. But they'd shipped it all over the world to different military installations and non-military labs for quote-unquote testing for their biosensors. Now, yesterday we talked about biosensors and how after 2001, September 11th, they started the mantra for bioterror and made us all afraid that there was going to be a big bioterror attack. So they started developing these microsensors that they could put everywhere, and now it's gotten to the point where they have microsensors that they can embed into your cell phone. They have little applications and cards you can plug in. You know, I was even postulating that someday, very soon, you'll be able to spit or probably even lick your screen. Put a cover on it. And they'll be able to do online diagnostics of what ails you remotely. Something I didn't know about, though, and I stumbled across this yesterday, was apparently a program that was created by the feds right after September 11th, quote-unquote, anthrax attack. So check this out. It's called BioWatch. BioWatch is a United States federal government program. And this was right around the time of Project BioShield 2, where Bush was allowing untested drugs by biopharma that would protect us against anthrax as well as all these other different pathogens. They were going to put them into the national stockpile in the case of an emergency and allow these untested drugs to be used on the American public. Remember, though, we looked at this 21st Century Care Act that's coming through Congress is going to get rid of all that. We don't need an emergency anymore to be able to use untested drugs on the public. They are going to allow a direct connect between big pharma, desperately sick people, and untested drugs and devices to be able to, quote-unquote, speed the pace of innovation. And instead of doing years of testing before they launch it on the public, they are now going to allow sick people to be the guinea pigs and offer themselves up knowingly to then become a case study after the fact to prove its efficacy. All right, so let's get back to this BioWatch. BioWatch is a United States federal government program that detects the release of pathogens into the air as part of a terrorist attack on major American cities. Hey, let's sell this one to the American public and see if we can get their stress hormones up. Reportedly operating in Philadelphia, New York City, and I knew about New York. I had read all about those little biosensors in New York. I have a sister that lives there. I've been there many, many times. So New York is something that I pay attention to. Washington, D.C., San Diego, Boston, Chicago, San Francisco, Atlanta, St. Louis, Houston, Los Angeles, as well as 21 other cities. The BioWatch program was created in 2001 in response to the increased threat of bioterrorism sparked by what? Ho-ho! The 2001 fake anthrax attacks. And it was announced in President George W. Bush's State of the Union address when, in 2003... The program, described as the, quote, nation's first early warning network of sensors to detect biological attacks, operates via a system of filters located within, oh, yes, the ones that we trust so much, the Environmental Protection Agency air filters that monitor air quality. What, you mean the ones that were all turned off after Fukushima, the ones that were all recalibrated, I don't even remember that bitch's name that used to run that agency. I can't remember her name. I couldn't stand her. She was such a lying sack of shit. They recalibrated all of those meters after Fukushima, after taking them all down, so it didn't look like anyone was getting any type of radiation. Yes, those same air filter monitors And they were also being administered by a third-party agency, by the way, that wasn't doing their job. Jackson, that was her last name. Results from these filters are then analyzed by the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, and oh, I'm sure that happens really often, who then pass any significant results on to the Federal Bureau of Investigation. And I'm going to tell you something. I could guarantee you that if it's not already happening, it's going to be in the near future. Now that they have all this biosensing capability in your mobile devices, I will guarantee you they've been making phones. If you read about some of the new phones and how they're made, a lot of them are waterproof now with some sort of nanomaterial. At least the Androids are. And it made me wonder a long time back, if they weren't doing something special with that nanomaterial, and wouldn't it be interesting if they were embedding some sort of nano sensors that could then detect and broadcast anything that's in the environment, not only bioterrorism agents, but things in smoke, let's say, or, you know, things in your environments that then they are keeping tabs of. Just saying. As of mid-2012, the system had generated a large number of false alarms, with more than 50 such cases documented between 2003 and 2008. And state and local health officials have never ordered evacuations or distributed emergency medicines, Project BioShield, in response to a positive reading from a system. Wow, guys, you know, this is something. So this Project BioWatch has been going on since 2003. What would it take, now that all of our cell phones have that emergency alert system on it, what would it take for a false alarm? Bam, 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 there has been an anthrax attack reported in your area. Don't pass go or collect $200. Head directly to your nearest FEMA camp to get your anthrax vaccination. Bam, bam, bam. I mean, honestly, I didn't know about this program. I mean, like I said, I knew that they had these little sensors everywhere, but I did not know that it was part of a federal BioWatch program that was part of national security, that was connected in, I mean, how many? 20, 30, 40 cities, and who knows how many more, that then was connected to Project BioShield, the untested drugs from BioPharma that are all waiting to go into human trials, but haven't been allowed to. State and local health officials have never ordered evacuations, right? So thank goodness. But they could in the future. Let's talk about the origins of Project BioWatch. In 2001, the anthrax attacks in the United States, also known as, I've never heard this before, Amerithrax from the FBI case name, occurred over the course of several weeks beginning on September 18th, 2001, how convenient, it was 1 week after September 11th. And anyone who did not hear that interview from Tim Kelly this week, make sure you go hit it on the YouTube channel, youtube.com/UCYTV, no dot. And it's Our Interesting Times with Tim Kelly. The professor's name was Graham something, and I'm sorry, I don't remember your last name, but you'll see it. I titled it, so you'll see it's about the 2001 anthrax attacks. Very interesting. The man has done a lot of research into the bullshit of 9/11. Letters containing anthrax spores were mailed to several news media offices and two Democratic U.S. senators, killing 5 people and infecting 17 others. And as a response, the U.S. increased countermeasure research funding and funding into the public health sector. Yes, ding, ding. Let's start coming up with mad science gone mad vaccines with federal taxpayer dollars. That's what they did. And before the BioWatch program, the quickest method of detecting the presence of an infectious material was through the diagnosis of infected patients. However, the most effective treatments take place prior to infection or in its early stages. So while the Central Intelligence Agency maintains that the use of bioterrorism in the United States is unlikely, The BioWatch program was created in 2001 in conjunction with the FBI, the EPA, the United States Department of Homeland Security, and the U.S. Laboratory Response Network for Bioterrorism, and was tested by the Center for Disease Control and Prevention and the Association of Public Health Laboratories. Wow, doesn't that sound like a great cabal orgy of alphabet agencies? Very interesting, though, that the CIA, and they're actually, there's been some controversy that I've read about recently back in 9/11, where I think it was the CIA, had actually been calling bullshit on a lot of things at the beginning and didn't think that attacks were coming, even though others within other divisions were saying attacks were coming. So I don't know. There's definitely something to this. Maybe somebody had a conscience. It says the original 31 city program only cost $60 million to implement, with a proposed expansion that came in 2005 that cost $118 million. So I'm sure also there were a lot of different people from those groups that were invested in these new technologies, just like we had Chertoff with his nude scanner company that when he left DHS, he cashed in as well. It says on October 9, 2003, a BioWatch filter in Houston, Texas, detected, quote, low levels of a bacterium called tularemia, T-U-L-A-R-E-M-I-A, and three consecutive days of positive results were recorded. Additional tests were taken, and the local area was watched for signs of infection among the population. And while an investigation is still ongoing, director of the Houston Department of Health and Human Services said that, quote, we are investigating to determine if the bacteria is always present or it's newly present or if it represents a health threat to the community. Small amounts of the tularemia bacteria were again detected in BioWatch filters in the mall area and elsewhere at Washington, D.C., the morning after an anti-war demonstration on September 24, 2005, biohazard sensors were triggered at six locations. And while thousands of people were potentially exposed, there were no infections reported. Well, kind of just like they've done with the radiation. They watched it. They said, hey, look, elevated levels, but let's not tell anyone, and let's just watch it, and now let's just recalibrate in the radiation instance. And what's even more interesting about all of this was something else that I had read, is that Google had then jumped on board with some of this flu mapping, and I don't know if they were doing and how far this Project BioWatch got for mapping different pathogens it finds in the air. But Google was doing a flu mapping for the CDC at one point. And I went out there. There was a link in one of the stories I was reading. I went out there, and the maps are all gone. The raw data is still out there, but you need to now sign up with Google. And it says if you're a university institution that wants use of this data, blah, 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 here's our sign-up form here. So it's got to make you wonder if Google isn't still involved mapping some of this BioWatch stuff that they're collecting. I mean, there's at least 31 cities, and we haven't heard anything about an upgrade now in this article since 2005, but I could guarantee you there's been all kinds of upgrades. And I know that I have read about some of this stuff using the mobile phones. There's bazillions of people with mobile phones, and they're in every city everywhere, and they have their phones with them. How would that not be a primary wonderful place to be doing biosensing 24/7? All right, let's read the last section of this. Response and criticism. The BioWatch system has received a mix of responses since coming online, many that result in a waste of resources and a lowering public confidence in the system. The congressional report in 2003 recorded that there was a number of concerns that the BioWatch filters would fail to detect indoor or underground releases, which is very true because a lot of these EPA monitors are on the tops of buildings. And also that the existence of the BioWatch filters in some cities would direct terrorists to attack other cities without such protection. And yes, you can go right to the EPA's website and see a map of where all of these EPA monitors are for radiation. And these are the same monitors that they're using. The report also highlighted the risks of the filters themselves being detected and destroyed. The report also states that the EPA filters are located based on different policies. Yeah, it's supposed to be under the EPA. And when the whole Fukushima debacle came out, we discovered that they had hired these third-party agencies that really weren't even maintaining the stuff. Half of the units were broken, and nobody was really paying attention to the filters. The report also states the EPA filters are located based on different policies that would provide optimum locations for counter-bioterrorism sensors, and the BioWatch filters may not be optimally located, on the tops of buildings, like I said. Furthermore, the BioWatch system may miss releases that take place within the gaps of coverage. So the House of Representatives also concluded that models used to predict the spread of an infectious agent after release and detection may be inaccurate, which would be a perfect reason to put it into your cell phone. On the ground and with everyone, using your hands and touching things all around and then touching your phone. The congressional report also raises concerns as to whether BioWatch can detect pathogens in large polluted cities, as well as issues related to the BioWatch filter reporting harmful pathogens that are actually within safe background levels and thus would throw up more positive hits than actual investigation warrants. There are also concerns that the BioWatch filters kill whatever pathogens have set them off, thus removing the possibility of further testing being undertaken. And finally, concerns were raised in the congressional report regarding the sensitivity of the filters and the fact that each filter would be exposed to different environmental conditions, and thus a standard detection rate would be nearly impossible to achieve. The complicated response that would be required should the BioWatch filter detect a pathogen would also be difficult to implement and put a strain on local health authorities. Funding, policy, and evaluation of effectiveness were all areas of concern. So in June of 2013, Mike Walter, the manager of the Office of Health Affairs BioWatch program, made a few remarks during his testimony to the House Committee on Energy and Commerce's Subcommittee on Oversight and Investigations. And Walters said that the benefits of the BioWatch program give public health decision makers more time and more options to mitigate a bioterrorist event. He said that early detection is critical to the successful treatment of affected populations and provides public health decision makers more time and thereby more options in responding to, mitigating, and recovering from a bioterrorist event. I mean, that's blabber. If the bioagent is detected and assessed to be the result of an act of bioterrorism and a threat to public health, prophylactic treatment, yes, can be started prior to widespread onset of symptoms. Line right up because your mandatory vaccines are coming, resulting in what? Oh, more lives saved with our untested vaccines. He also, because we're under Project BioShield at that point, and he also talked about the federal, state, and local partnership, the tools for preparedness, and is developing robust quality assurance, as well as assessing new technologies to shorten decision time in relation to bioagent detection. So, there you go, and I'm trying to find really quick if this will load. I did have a story, and I closed it because I wasn't going to talk about this stuff today. Being able to use cell phones. Here we go. New technology for smartphones and paper to analyze sample. paper samples that can be analyzed using an Android program on a smartphone could be used to detect pesticides rapidly and cheaply, according to a new study published in Biosensors and Bioelectronics. And not only was there a story about pesticides, but there was also, wow, look, my keyboard doesn't even work now. Oh, and now my browser disappeared. So I guess that's it. I'm not going to be able to search another story. Hold on. I'm going to try this other biosensor. Oh, well, guys, we have to have a cluster F show every once in a while, and it wasn't my fault. Yeah, here we go. Biosensor and cell phone. And biosensing with cell phones, using a cell phone as a biosensor. Cell and nanoparticle transport. Yeah, guys, we'll read about this one tomorrow, but I knew I had read something about this. Chance conversation, blah, 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 became reality now, and they're being able to use your cell phones for biosensors. All right, guys, we got about 20 seconds left. Sorry about the issues I was having. I don't know what was going on here, but it seems like it's okay now. Hopefully everything is cool for Lonnie. Make sure you stick around because tonight is Wednesday night. We have Lonnie Clark up live next. Josh live at 6 p.m. Eastern. What comes after that? I don't even remember. Oh, yes, the boys from New York. Jonathan and Steven at 8 p.m. Eastern. Truth or Talk with April and Burstein at 9 p.m. And at 11, we have Anti-Meeting Radio with Nick Burnaby and D.B. Schwartz coming up live. So it should be a good one. Make sure you stick around because Wednesday is always fun. And there's my music. All right, guys, have an awesome Wednesday. Hope you're warm and dry. And I will catch up with you tomorrow. Everybody, take care.
By 2020, we'll have computers that are powerful enough to simulate the human brain, but we won't be finished yet with reverse engineering the human brain and understanding its methods. One of my main themes, and I've developed this thesis over 30 years, is that information technology grows exponentially. The power of computers, our understanding of the human brain, the spatial resolution of brain scanning, the number of bits we move around the internet, I mean, many different measures of information technology double every 1 year, or every 11 months, 13 months, depending on what you're measuring. So these technologies will be a million times more powerful within 20 years. In fact, the speed of exponential growth is itself speeding up. So in 25 years, these technologies will be a billion times more powerful than they are today. And we've already seen that kind of progress. When I was an undergraduate, we all shared a computer at MIT that took up half a building. The computer on your cell phone today is a million times cheaper and 1,000 times more powerful. That's a billion-fold increase in price performance of computing since I was an undergraduate. By 2029, and I've been quite consistent on this date, we will have completed the reverse engineering of the human brain. And we've already made very good progress on that. We've reverse engineered a number of different regions, like the cerebellum, which is responsible for our skill formation, and slices of the cerebral cortex where we do our recursive thinking, and the auditory cortex, the visual cortex, and so on. By 2029, we'll have reverse engineered and modeled and simulated all the regions of the brain, and that will provide us the software, algorithmic methods to simulate, you know, all of the human brain's capabilities, including our emotional intelligence. And computers at that time will be far more powerful than the human brain. And we'll be able to create machines that really do have the subtlety and suppleness of human intelligence. And they'll combine that power with ways in which machines are already superior to us. Harness all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. It can remember billions of things accurately. They can share knowledge at electronic speeds that are a million times faster than human language. So it'll be a very powerful combination. But the last point I'll make is that it's not some alien invasion of intelligent machines coming from Mars to invade us. It's coming from within our civilization. And the whole point of it is to extend our reach. Ever since we picked up a stick to reach a higher branch, we've used our tools to extend our reach. We can now already extend our reach mentally. I can take out a device from my pocket and access all of human knowledge with a few keystrokes. Half the farmers in China have these devices and can do the same thing. It is spawning a real cultural revolution in China and around the world, and these tools are continuing to grow exponentially in power. The singularity is not just that point where we achieve human level of intelligence in the machine. I mean, that will start a new revolution where these machines will continue to grow exponentially in power. They'll be able to actually improve their own software design. By 2045, we'll have expanded the intelligence of our human-machine civilization a billion-fold. That will be a singularity. We borrowed this metaphor from physics to talk about an event horizon that's hard to see beyond. It's not the case that I'm only looking at the optimistic side. I mean, I am an optimist, and I do think we've been helped more than we've been hurt by technology already. Human life expectancy was 37 in 1800, and human life was very hard, disaster-prone, labor-filled, disease-filled, and so on. But I've actually written extensively about the dangers of all this. Bill Joy's article on the cover of Wired magazine, Why the Future Doesn't Need Us, which talked about the grave dangers of genetics, nanotechnology, and robotics, came from my book. He says at the beginning of the article, he got these ideas from my book, The Age of Spiritual Machines. And chapter 8 of The Singularity is Near is called The Deeply Intertwined Promise Versus Peril of GNR, Genetics, Nanotechnology, and Robotics. I'm working extensively with the Army to develop a rapid response system to deal with the possible abuse of biotechnology. So about the same technologies that are empowering us to reprogram biology away from cancer and heart disease could also be used by a bioterrorist to reprogram a biological virus to be more deadly or more communicable. And the good news is we actually have the scientific tools to defend ourselves, just like we defend ourselves from software viruses with a rapid response system. And we need to put a system like that in place. But it's not accurate to say that I'm only painting a rosy future and that I have a utopian vision. My vision's not utopian. The power of these technologies will grow exponentially. I believe that is inexorable. That has gone on for the last 110 years since the 1890 census. What we do with these technologies is not preordained. That future history has not been written. I am very concerned about the downsides. I've written extensively about them, and in fact I'm working on defending against those. I am optimistic that we will get more promise than peril, but they both exist. Technology's been a double-edged sword ever since fire and stone tools. Well, I've been very active in talking about the downside of technology, and there are dangers. A danger we face right now is the ability for a bioterrorist to use our biological sciences to reprogram a biological virus to be deadly or communicable. And we have the ideas to combat that, but they're not yet in place. And so I think that's an existential risk we need to deal with very quickly. There'll be new dangers from these new technologies. I mean, I'm optimistic, but not sanguine. And I'm not necessarily convinced that we won't encounter painful episodes. I think overall we'll be helped more than we're hurt. But, I mean, you only have to look at the 20th century. We had 180 million people die in the wars of the 20th century. That scale of destruction was made possible by technology. We've also helped ourselves enormously, because human life expectancy was 48 in 1900. So we need to address these dangers and downsides. I mean, that's what worries me.
Now, because computer power keeps doubling every 18 months, it means that that will affect biology, specifically genomics, meaning that within 10 years' time, I expect us to have a CD-ROM with every single gene in our body costing about $1,000. And that'll be the basis of all your medicine, which means that we'll be able to scan millions of genomes with a computer, and that can create a revolution in how we numerically analyze genes. For example, let's say we have 1 million old people and 1 million young people. We sequence the genes of old people, we sequence the genes of young people, because all of them have a CD-ROM, and we subtract. That allows you to isolate where aging takes place, specifically which genes are damaged in the aging process. Think of a car. Where does aging take place in a car? Well, the engine. Why? Because that's where combustion takes place. That's where we have the gum of deposits and soot build up in the engine, because that's where oxidation takes place. Well, where does oxidation take place in the cell? The mitochondria. The mitochondria is the engine of the cell. So we now know where aging takes place. And by scanning the genes, we'll be able to look at the genes of the mitochondria and be able to repair some of those genes. And that could open up a whole new realm of biology. In other words, biology will be reduced to computer science.